Most important leader is to demonstrate with their behaviors, their commitment is to ensure everybody has an understanding of the direction of the organization, and then to be the cheer squad. I'm a believer that you need to have the right level of support, and you need to have someone who can speak in two tongues. You know, one tongue is the executive tongue, and the other one is the tongue for people in the workplace, if that makes sense.
Welcome to KPI Fireside. Our mission is simple: to improve companies and to improve careers through continuous improvement. In every episode, we explore the spark, the moment, the mindset, or the method that ignites real change. Whether you're just starting out or leveling up, you'll find the insights and inspiration to fuel your next improvement. Welcome back to KPI Fireside, a continuous improvement podcast. I am your host, Keith Norris. Our guest today is Pete Goff. Pete spent his entire career driving transformation in complex organizations. He's been instrumental in helping drive hundreds of millions of dollars of business improvement in roles at Rio Tinto, Newcrest, Kagara, and Goldfields. He's an expert in building business improvement into the culture, where he helped shape the career paths of many top leaders in the mining industry today. Pete is recently retired, so I'm super happy to have him on the podcast where we can dig into what made him so successful over all those years. I first met Pete in 2018 in Western Australia in Perth, and this is truly a conversation I've been looking to have for a number of years. Pete, you're one of the guys that I thought of when I first thought of doing this podcast. Like, I'd love to have conversations with folks like Pete Goff. So welcome to the podcast.
Thanks, Keith. You make that career sound a little more wonderful than it was actually. it sounds great. I like it. 2018, it goes so quickly when you came on board and provided a solution for something we were looking for with KPI Fire. It was much appreciated at the time. And it's still in place at this point in time now. Here we are, 2025, and it's still chugging away and satisfying the needs of the company, which has grown significantly.
Well, that's super, super exciting. Super exciting. Well, Pete, we like to start the podcast off with a little segment we call The Spark. And for you, this might be going back a little ways, but The Spark, as we think about it, is like this moment where you've obviously spent a large part of your career in this continuous improvement discipline. I'm curious if you remember the moment where you decided that this is what you wanted to do when you grew up.
Yeah, well, I have to go back right outside of mining, because I worked in electricity generation and distribution for 23 years before I even went to mining. And the last part of that was predominantly in employee relations and industrial relations. I remember the point in time thinking that it didn't matter what we achieved in the Industrial Relations Commission, which is the court that we go to ratify changes or improvements in an organization. It didn't matter what we decided there, because we'll then have to go back to the workplace and tell people what was best for the way they did their job. And in conversation with the general manager and the site that I was working, we said, wouldn't it be great if people had the opportunity to work out for themselves the improvements that we needed to make, not just be told what would make their jobs better or make the performance better. And that was really the genesis of the whole thing, because that's where we got interested. Originally, it was with Florida Power and Light, an offshoot of that, that they were very much Demingites. And first time I'd actually come across W. Edwards Deming was at that point in time, and so got very interested in the approach that he took. It wasn't 100% fit, but it was a different way of doing things. And then started to look at the Toyota production system a little bit. So this was back pre-2000, before the world ended with the 2000 calamity that was going to happen.
Y2K.
So the Y2K, that's it. We, from that point, it wasn't that much longer. I actually left electricity generation and distribution and made my way to Western Australia to join a mining company as a leader for their, was originally their Six Sigma, and eventually became their business improvement program. And that covered a few mines in Western Australia, a big uranium mine in South Australia. So it was all Australian based. And that was really the start of that whole what ended up being the rest of my career up until 2025. And I got to say, I never looked back on it once. It was always interesting. Yeah. So that was the spark. It was the point in time where I realized that it was no fun for people and there was no commitment with us telling them what would improve their work rather than them deciding themselves, which is, you know, very much the fundamentals of the Toyota production system.
That's funny. It sounds
like... Does that make sense?
Absolutely. I think one thing that I find interesting about this work as well is that spark or that switch where people go from perhaps being disengaged to being empowered to feel like I'm frustrated with this thing that's happening or the way it's done, and go from being like negative or disengaged to like positive, like I can make this better somehow. And then, of course, you know, once you get somebody tipping in the right direction, then there's a whole bunch of like, you know, processes and methods and, you know, tools that you can use to make that happen.
Mm.
One of the things that I think is really interesting, you told me a story one time, and maybe it's just the approach that you guys had put together, and I'm sure it evolved over time. But at Goldfields, I seem to recall, like, you guys had kind of a unique way of combining this lean discipline, continuous improvement with like change leadership program. Maybe you could talk a little bit about where you guys got to and if that was an evolution, maybe how you came to that point.
Yeah, look, that went right through from the conversation we had some years ago, and it's being paused at the moment because we've run two or three or four programs a year since that time, since the genesis of it. So I was one of those who came through and did my Six Sigma Black Belt training along with a host of other people, did some lean training, did some organizational change training, but there were gaps in between all of those things. And I kind of thought of it as back when I grew up, you were either a kid, you attended the judo club or the karate club or the boxing club or whatever it happened to be, but they were all different. And they were all run differently, and they're all separate disciplines, and never the two shall meet. It's a bit like MMA. It takes a little bit of jiu-jitsu, a little bit of judo, a little bit of karate, and a little bit of boxing. And I'm not into blood sports particularly, but that's the same. That's an example of what we tried to achieve. It wasn't about which discipline. It was about what do I need to get the job done. And so that was the approach we took. There was a person that I'd crossed paths with and worked briefly over the years with for probably 20 that became a partner in delivering the lean and the Six Sigma part of it. And another person that I'd worked with for years previously that was all about the developing the leadership capability to bring about change as well. So what do I need to know about myself? What do I need to know about other people in order to implement change? And fundamental to the whole thing was things had to be practical. We had to have a practical approach and not too much text, all about building a model that people could apply and see working with their own eyes. So it was very much a model-based approach where people would turn up and it was all about scales and cups and process flow and applying lean tools and increasing the throughput or reducing the variation with the application of Six Sigma tools. From that point, so there was a training component to it. And we had really good, strong support from the operations VP and the EV executive vice president for the regions who didn't participate, but would always come to the opening of the training and talk about the business and what was important to the business. And believe it or not, you could go 12 months later and go and talk to one of the people who attended and said, "What sticks out in your memory about the training course?" And they would say almost always the first thing was when the EVP came down, took time out of their week and sat down and talked to us, a bit like the fireside chat we're having at the moment. And he took time to talk to us about the business and what was important and what we needed to consider and where the business was going. And that kicked it all off and set people's minds in the right direction. There was purpose for what they were doing. The follow-up to that was we provided what we call shark tanks. I don't know if you have the same television show in the US, but it's where someone has a great idea and the sharks circle and either buy it or kick it out. And so there were shark tanks each month for the participants at the training. They had to deliver a project. Before they graduated, they'd have to deliver a project. Graduation became a polo shirt and a certificate. And you wouldn't believe how important it was to people to get that polo shirt and the certificate. They'd finished their project, they'd done their training, they had it signed off. Once they had got sign off at their site, the operating site they're working at, they would then take that and have to do a presentation to the site leadership team and then go and make a presentation on their project to the regional leadership team. And the emphasis that was placed on that by those people who had probably never seen the whole regional team in one location before, let alone being a part of the agenda for the monthly meeting, it was quite a significant event in their minds. And it went very well. So there was right from the fundamental training and selection, taking a completely different approach of the MMA rather than the fundamental schools of karate and judo, and right through to completion and presentation to the regional leadership team. And it worked quite well. I was very, very pleased with the way that worked.
You alluded to a couple of things I want to drill into there. The first one, you talked about the executive presentation when we're talking about implementing a program. You know, we always talk about having strong executive buy-in. I want to come back to that for a minute. So how exactly did you structure that, and how did you prepare those executives for, you know, what they needed to communicate in that? Like, how much time did you give them? What kind of prep did you do for them?
That's an interesting one, actually, because there's an element of trust when you're in our business. There's an element of trust, I guess. And it was a bit like under you know, the old three shell trick, and under one of them is a pearl. It was a bit of that. So trust me, this is going to be really good. There's a little bit of that, and then taking them through what we were trying to achieve. Look, most, I don't know any that are not, but most executive are hungry for their workforce to become involved in the business. They're hungry for their workforce to be motivated to bring about change that improves things. They want to know that we're getting the fully utilizing the capacity that we've got, and they want to keep their costs under control as best they can. So when you look at it and you present a little package that says, this is what we can do, and by the way, it's going to bring our workforce closer to our leadership team and closer to the goals of the business, it's almost a sales pitch you can't walk past. So my job really was to construct the model and then to bring those people in and talk to them about why each of the stages was so important. And once we'd seen the first round, I got a lot more buy-in. There was a lot more that act of bringing people from the operating sites into the regional leadership team meetings, doing their presentation, all their words, they're limited to a maximum of 4 to 6 PowerPoint slides. Their work, they had to stand up there. The beads of sweat on their foreheads as they were giving their presentation, and how keen they were to answer any questions, their enthusiasm for their solutions, it's very contagious. Very, very contagious.
That. Okay, so I wanna deconstruct this a little bit. We've got this engaged executive who's brought in by you in this operational excellence continuous improvement role as a facilitator, but you've got these people that are working and, you know, for context, you're working in mines. People are underground. I haven't been in one of those mines myself, but I can imagine better, more pleasant places to work. I can imagine that, you know, I'm curious to hear how you decided to, you know, who to invite into this training program. Give me an example. Like, how many people would you put into one of these waves or phases that you would train?
Okay. 20 people.
20? Okay.
20 to 25 people.
Out of a workforce
of 1,000?
1,000. Okay. How did you select those 20? What did somebody have to do to get noticed out of the 1,000 to be in the 20?
Initially, it was seeking applications. We kind of knew who we wanted. It's those people that are banging on the door of a promotion, those people who are always first to put their hand up when there's something extra that needs to be done. Those people that you would always go to when you went to site and you had a question about things. They were the people we targeted first. And I'm pleased to say a good number moved through the ranks afterwards because they were able to demonstrate the capacity, the capability, because there was a vehicle for doing so, a change leader project, which he didn't always get support for. It's a different kettle of fish when you say, I want to make a change, and you go into the general manager, want to change this. Oh, yeah, I've got 6,000 other things to do, but I'll get back to you. I've got a change leader project, and if I do it, I can take it to the regional leadership team. I'll look good, you'll look good, and we'll get this change underway. Look, there's there's a number of projects, but one in particular from one of these people, and it was called the Lamborghini of pumps. He worked out how much what the cost of maintaining this particular pump in an underground mine was on an annual basis, and not a single pump, numerous pumps of the same type. And it ended up being as much as it would cost to buy a Lamborghini. So rather than saying, I'm going to use my flight pump, I'm going to use the title of improving flight pump performance, he said, the Lamborghini of pumps. Straight away, he had engagement. What are you talking about, the Lamborghini of pumps? And so there was cleverness, and there's almost an unspoken challenge between the participants about how to make this a little bit quirky, how to make this fun, how to make this still effective, but make it fun. Look, we were lucky as well, partnering with this particular gentleman, that if anyone wanted to get details, I'm happy to pass, but probably not in this forum, that work with us to get these things developed and followed the training right through, and drag himself around the mine sites with me a few times to meet people on the job and see how they're going with their projects. And so it was a team. So I hope that answers your question. I think
that's one thing that I recall from talking to you is how you guys had, even just with the naming of it, like the change leader program and connecting it with some change leader training, it seems to me that you might have aligned your Lean Six Sigma projects with, I kind of think of it as maybe with the HR department and like the career track, like, hey, if somebody wants to get a promotion, they need to be involved in this. Is that a correct interpretation?
It was treated that way. There wasn't a written mandate, but it was definitely an opportunity for people that they didn't have previously. There is always, and there always will be, those people who float to the surface simply because of their drive or their intelligence. There's people who have natural advantages, but having this fronting up to the regional leadership team, HR were definitely, they were key customers right from the outset with this, where I sat down with those people and said, look, this is what we're going to be doing. It needs to fit in with your career development activities. Are we aligned? Everything was good. And yes, there was an advantage in participating and in fronting up to the regional leadership team. One other thing I'll mention, Keith, that was probably instrumental in helping us gain momentum. This was just pre-COVID. Unfortunately, COVID came along and stopped a lot of things on fly-in, fly-out mine sites. But we held every 6 months a conference, a change leader conference, where every change leader who finished a project would have to do an one size poster that walked through what their particular projects were. And you know, the Lamborghini of pumps, to use that example again, was a Lamborghini of pumps, and it was describing what the problem was and how they fixed it and then the benefits and the savings. And I think the first one, we'd always get a guest speaker in from some other part of the world. We had one from a gentleman that I'd worked with previously on change management. And he came and talked to us about the importance of that. So there was an interest component to it. It wasn't all about change leaders. But then there was a review of all the change leader projects that had taken place up until that point in time. And I remember the executive vice president coming up and saying, there's over 50 of these projects that have been finished in this time. There's 50 posters on that wall. I had no idea. And it was that, in your face right there, these are the things that my workforce are doing that really helped engage and lock in that executive level buy-in. So when you can get the whole regional leadership team of say 6 or 8 or 10, 9 people there, and they're all attending and they're participating for a full day out of their schedules, it's a pretty good outcome. I was pretty happy getting that sort of a roll up.
That's awesome. 50 posters on the wall for the executives to see there. So the program itself, what's the language that you guys would use for the job titles for your people that were facilitating the program? Was it business improvement, continuous improvement, operational excellence? What kind of job titles were you using?
Yeah, we use business improvement manager and specialist, or senior specialist. So yeah, that was the title. Again, BI, it's business improvement. It's not necessarily when I first started, I was a Six Sigma something or other. I don't even remember what it was, but I was locked into Six Sigma. The downside with that was we saw the organization trying to fix problems that weren't about variation. And we were trying to squeeze every problem into a DMAIC process, which was, I guess, was where I started thinking, this is not working. So, yes, back to your question. So we called the official job titles were all about being business improvement, as I said, managers, superintendents, specialists or senior specialists. Not very many. There wasn't very many, unfortunately. Fortunately or unfortunately, it forced us to collaborate fairly heavily, but again, leverage off of the change leader training and the need to graduate, the need to deliver a project.
I love it. I think the stuff that I've heard from you and that sort of model, I think, is a very good model to replicate. I've seen similar versions of it in a lot of industries and organizations. So just to kind of help paint some comparisons here. You guys have, at the peak, how many different sites or locations were you operating the improvement program across?
We had four large sites. Four large sites here in Australia. Another site in South Africa that adopted, at least in part, the program, and some of the South American parts of the business, they hadn't done so, but we hadn't translated to Spanish either. They had a get out of jail free card there.
It's one thing that I've noticed. It seems like if an organization has one site, of course, every organization has some version of business improvement happening, even if it's just, people solving problems, et cetera. When you have multiple sites, when you go from one to two and two to three and three to four, it seems like the opportunities to do some structured business improvement are, I don't know if exponential is the right word, but it seems like there's much more opportunities. The example that I use is if you just have one site operating and you've got, whether it's cost of goods or cost of quality or cost of any sort of cost across your business, that's just what it is. But when you have multiple sites, you see like three costs right here and then one up here, and you can say, there's an opportunity for improvement. You can identify these opportunities for improvement a little bit more easily across multiple sites.
Mm.
One of the things that I think you guys were always pretty good at is we would use the term hard savings, kind of dollarizing the improvement. Is that something that you guys always did, or is that like a discovery you made along the way?
I hate to say this, but I think it's got better since I left. No, look, we weren't always good at that. We look at the value of the activity as if the rest of the process could cope with whatever we produced. And that wasn't always the case. There was a hard stop somewhere that said, you can save money. Don't get me wrong, we know it's always important. There's got to be a benefit, cost benefit analysis. Is it worth making the change? Is it going to pay back? Is it going to benefit the organization or not? Does it matter to the organization whether we, whether we fix it or we don't fix it? Who's going to care? Like I said, I think there's a lot more emphasis placed on that right now in the organization, because the organization has picked up the business improvement work, not just the Australasian aspect of the business, and it's got a lot of emphasis now. I've been in there a few times, and I'm really pleased with the effort that goes into doing exactly that, understanding what the hard benefits are. Still room for soft benefit as well, but they definitely around those hard benefits. So building the budgets.
How would you teach or train or explain like hard benefits versus soft benefits for anybody that's not familiar with those terms?
Okay. Hard benefits are those you put in your budget, those that are of a dollar value. that will impact the bottom line. The soft benefits are those that may change the way people work, make their jobs easier, make their jobs better, that don't necessarily affect the bottom line. You can improve them and it'll be a better workplace, but not necessarily a cheaper product or a bigger margin.
How do you guys go about setting annual targets for the savings? Would you do a top down? Would you do identify all the projects and do bottom up? Did you try different things? What did you learn from trying different approaches, or what do you recommend? What works best?
Look, we always worked top down. It was a target set. There wasn't a lot of science in that number. It was always a bit of a stretch target. The problem with a bottom up approach can be that, well, this is all I can get. Take it or leave it. The problem with a top down approach is that it can be unrealistic. Again, the CEO and the executive of the organization, not the regional executive, but the executive of the organization, take a much greater interest in that aspect of the program these days. So typically, the CEO now signs off on what the hard benefits will be from the BI program, which is tough, but it's got to pay. That's the way it works.
Is there a rule of thumb that you saw used, like percent of revenue, percent of cost?
Yeah, we had a 3% of cost target.
That was a target that you'd refresh each year and every year trying to get 3%.
Yeah, sometimes it would move by 0.5%, but you could say, was it a realistic target? Did we always get it? No, we didn't, but we tried to. So that was, I guess, a part of the whole process of establishing a top-down target. You know, you don't always get what you want. But keep in mind we had very few resources that were full-time business improvement resources. Each of those large sites of 1,000 or 2,000 people, you might only have 3 or 4 business improvement people. So, and sometimes only 1 or 2 on a mine site if it was a small mine site. So hard yards, and there wasn't a lot of time apart from the face-to-face work, the money-generating work. So
when you say 1 or 2 or 3 or 4 people help facilitating those projects, you use some numbers like 20 people getting trained each year. At a site of 1,000, is that one physical site, 1,000 people?
It can be, yes, one of them, yes.
So let's just say that, you know, kind of using round numbers, and you said you'd have maybe like 3 or 4 people working in a business improvement role. I'm assuming that they're like facilitating. You said at one mine you had as many as 50 projects. Is that like in a calendar year?
Yeah. And keep in mind, so the projects could be small. We could be a 5S project in a warehouse or a mechanical workshop. It could be a standardized work on a truck service. It could be right up until some of them. I recall one presentation to the senior executive team where one of the gentlemen that finished his change leader training filled the whiteboard with a mathematical equation that he had developed in order to improve the performance of the mill, you know, the money making, the wheel of fortune, we call it, where the gold is actually poured and extracted and poured. And this was a hugely complex problem that he'd tackled and come up with a solution to it. And I remember the absolute shock on the face of the regional leadership team seeing this mathematical equation as part of his presentation unfold on the whiteboard in front of them. Everyone just shaking their head and saying, we've got no idea whether you're right or wrong. But that's just the nature of business improvement. Some of the problems are complex. You know, some of those that you think are going to be simple and easy to do and end up quite difficult, and sometimes the other way around. I call it the tipping point, from where it goes out of the analytical phase and where you're pulling it all apart and coming up with a solution. That tipping point that then says you implement those solutions and people buy in, they own the different way of doing things now. Basically, tell you, get out of my way. This is the way we do things now. I don't need you anymore. That's the tipping point, I think, when you move from the desktop and the whiteboard, and you're actually out there implementing it. And the more you can do on this side of the whiteboard for people to own it, the more likely it is to be successful to the other side, on the other side where it's out there in play.
I want to drill into that a little bit more. First, I want to finish off this topic of like program structure. So I'm kind of envisioning side of like 1,000 people. You said that you train about maybe 20 people a year or 20 people a phase.
20 people a wave. So we might run 3 or 4 waves a year. When it was at its peak, we'd run 3 or 4 waves a year.
Okay. And so how many people would you have on the staff at a given time? You know, people come and go and, you know, that sort of thing. You're training so many people. I'm assuming that you would track, like, we've got X number of people that have been trained in this change management, business improvement methodology. What was kind of like an average number of people on staff that had been trained?
We would sit at around, you're making me go back here now, Keith. I would say it would probably be around 100 to 150 change leaders by the time we'd got to the end. There's definitely a point, and I'd say this, I think it's an interesting thing, but there's definitely a point where through your workforce, where bringing about change, doing the analysis, having that fire in your belly starts to drop off. There's every workforce is made up of high flyers, of those who just turn up and do their job and do it well, and those that need to be led and encouraged all the way to do a good job. There's a spectrum. There is a point where you run out of high flyers, and you can see it through something like a change leader program, where these people are hungry. You know, they turn up an hour early, they're ready to go, they want to know what's going to happen, and they finish their projects quickly when they go back to site, and they'll run 3 or 4 projects a year. And then you've got the others at the other end that you just have to go, come on, hurry up, come on, you can do it. What do you need? I'll help you. I don't think that's being derogatory to these people. It's just they're motivated by a different thing. They're not necessarily motivated by their work as much as you try. So at any point in time, you might have these high flyers that are knocking over 4, 5 projects a year, and the others that are doing their 1 or 2. We realized that they weren't full-time resources. They couldn't work full-time on business improvement activities. They have electrical jobs to do. They have other jobs they needed to do as well, planning or design or whatever it happened to be. It's an interesting field. You said you hadn't been to an underground mine yet. Differing, what struck me as different is going as a black belt to a mining area was that the variation in a production scenario, where you're producing widgets, you generally introduce the variation yourselves through the process somewhere. In mining, right from day one, right from the ground, the variation from when you first drill that hole, variation is introduced because that's the way the planet is.
Yeah.
There is variation. The gold might be here 1 gram per ton, and over there it's 15, and then it's 7, and then it's 2, then it's none. So variation is introduced right from the very outset. So you can't have very tight little parameters on your control chart. They're up here because it's got to cope with that.
Pete, a couple of super interesting topics. I'm curious if you would give us a quick lesson into how does gold go from inside the earth to, you know, I don't know what the final output of the commodity was, but maybe you could give us a quick crash course in the life cycle of, how gold is mined.
Well, okay. You're probably asking the wrong person, but I'll give it a go. It starts off with discovering where the gold actually is. And this is an amazing activity for me, the exploration guys. They drill these little holes down into the ground, and they could be 1, 2, 3 kilometers deep. And as they pull this out, the sections of the drill, they take the core out. And the geologists, who are very clever people, the geologists then crush and analyze that core to see where there's any gold and other elements as well. So if you think, okay, all your testing has proved there's gold there somewhere in that area, they drew a whole series of holes in it, and they're like 200 meters apart. And from there, they start to build a model of what the gold may actually look like in the ground, because some comes up from the bottom, and some's alluvial gold, which washes down like the old panners used to get in the Wild West out your way. They used to get it with a pan, so that's the alluvial gold, and they determine where the gold actually is, and then the design guys, the mining engineers, will design a mine plan to get to where that gold actually is, so you can follow it and mine it and most as efficiently as you can. So keep in mind, for an underground mine, you might be talking about 3 to 5 grams per ton of material that you have to shift. Yeah, it's not a lot. I mean, the great mines really in Australia have dropped off a bit. So they drill a series of holes, do a development drive first where they go down to the level where the gold is so the trucks can get down there, and then they follow follow down deeper where the gold actually lies. It's called development. They'll do their development drilling, they'll blast that, they'll clean it all away, they'll take it to the surface. If it's waste dump, if it's gold, it goes to the ROM pad, where it gets, we'll talk about the processing plant in a while, but and they'll keep following it down until it's no longer economic. And then the next sort of development drilling or exploration drilling, they might drill it from that tunnel where it goes under the ground, the development shaft. They'll drill out to different locations and find the next lot of gold from under the ground. So in Australia, we have some deep mines, but in Africa, one of the mines I'd go to in Africa was almost 4 kilometers under the ground.
So like a tube mine that goes 4 kilometers?
They have an elevator, a shaft, and then you have basically all your workshops or your little trains and everything run around 4 kilometers under the ground, or 3.6. I think the deepest in Africa is about 5.5 kilometers under the ground.
That's mind-blowing.
So you got the gold mixed with the rock, mixed with the sand, mixed with all that stuff up on the surface. It needs to go and get crushed. Yeah, they crush it up. They take the waste away from the gold. They put the gold through the refinery, and then it's molten and poured into gold bars and shipped off to the mint from there. Sold to the mint.
Where the commodities traders make prices up, and it's an interesting industry, you know, like the pricing that can, you know, change like that probably affects your work quite a bit.
Well, it kind of does, but if you look at cost and price follow each other, because it's been a story. I remember that when I first started, it was $600 an ounce. Now it's over 6,000. But cost has generally followed, and it's not just one company. It's pretty consistent. I mean, it's not unusual for a project. And this is, I don't know how you deal with this from a business improvement perspective, but we've seen steel, when we're building a project, go up by 30 or 40% from when the project starts until when it's finished. I mean, how do you budget or project manage for that?
Yeah, you
need a lot of BI people, mate, to fix that one.
Yeah. Well, that's interesting, Pete. I'm trying to picture what that, you know, a mine that goes 5 kilometers underground. That's just mind blowing.
Well, that's one of the truly good, I wouldn't call it great, but truly good improvement projects where we thought it would have a simple soft outcome, but it ended up with something completely different. When you're down 3.6 kilometers under the ground, the shaft is the way you bring all your people. They all come down at the start of the shift. They all go back up at the end of the shift. All the equipment, all the vehicles, everything that you need comes down this shaft and goes out like an ant's nest from that point forward. And one of the simple projects, the FIBES project that took place, really mainly with soft intentions, tidy this place up, make it safer, make it better to work in, make it more visible, throw away stuff that we don't need, gives us more space for the stuff we do. Ended up being a flow on because there's an underground rail network that is always short on wagons, and it holds things up all the time. It slows the production up, it slows your maintenance up. By fixing the 5S in there, they could unpack the wagons and load the materials off the wagons, which freed up the train, which allowed them to get the material to the shaft to get out more quickly, which allowed them to get their maintenance done more quickly. The flow-on effects were significant, and not there were benefits that were unintended when that activity first started. It was a simple activity, like 5S are meant to be, but the flow-on effects were multiple.
That sounds like a great project. Pete, I want to come back to this like career path a little bit. I'm curious, you know, you did this quite a while. I'm curious if there's somebody that maybe went through one of these training programs that you helped put together that went on to get some promotions or, you know, kind of had like a very successful career. Are there some examples or stories that you want to tell? Yep. Part of what we want to do is inspire people to learn these skills and these tools and to use them to advance their own careers.
Yeah, look, was it a formal link? You're a change leader, so you are promoted? No, it wasn't that. I'd love to be able to say that that was the case, but it certainly provided a good grounding for those people. There were numerous, and I'd say right up front that there were numerous people who were promoted as a consequence of the their performance, and part of their performance was being visible in front of. The senior people in the organization being motivated. What do you want from your leadership group? What do you want from a superintendent or a manager or an assistant manager? What do you want? You want someone who's motivated. You want someone who understands your business. You want someone who will facilitate others and develop others within their team. This gave them an opportunity to demonstrate that. We would never try to link change leader to a promotion. My fear with that would have been that it would have started to lead down the track of fudging, if I can use that name, fudging the numbers to say this was a project's worth $250,000. So therefore, I deserve that job.
So maybe a correlation but not causation.
Yes, 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 yes. Separating the two out of saying the change leader helps you get to where you're going versus you're already a motivated person anyway, and change leader just helped to polish that and gave you some new skills. Some of those people that were promoted, I talked to and said, did we help you? And they said, I'm not sure. I think so, because it was the best leadership development course I've ever been on, because it covers, you can't just have a bunch of tools and go and be an effective change leader. You need to understand how you need to behave, how you need other people to behave, and that's really leadership. So we spent a lot of time, and I did that intentionally because I've seen that be a failing in other improvement training in the past, whereas we deal with all the technical stuff because propeller heads, I'm putting myself in there, we love that stuff. But what we don't do is think about that tipping point to say, we've done all that propeller head stuff up into here. The analysis is great because I've seen some fantastic analysis for belly flopper on the other side of the tipping point because no one else owns it except the person doing the analysis. So we wanted to have the ability to keep it simple and have those simple things flow through the organization, through the affected area to bring the change about. Does that make sense? I'd encourage people to really look hard at that.
Yeah, I want to drill into this idea of having continuous improvement, operational excellence, business improvement as a function, as a department, as a responsibility inside of an organization. I know some companies just don't have that department. They think, oh, our leaders are responsible for running the business and making things better, or oh yeah, well we have some training or something, we'll train people. What might you say about the role of like a group like what you did? And if, you know, because I hear stories from people who say, yeah, well, we had a continuous improvement program, but then we got some new leadership and the program got cut. Like, why would that happen? And what can somebody in a CI role do to expand the impact of their function? How can they, what are some best practices you might share for that?
Okay. Look, I think any organization going through transformation in anything, take safety, right? You won't introduce a new safety program in an organization and just say, okay, off you go now, run it by yourself. You would get some support. You would get people to nurture it in the organization until it can walk, until it can run. That's the idea. That's change. You know, you go through that process. I'm a believer that you need to have the right level of support, and you need to have someone who can speak in two tongues. You know, one tongue is the executive tongue, and the other one is the tongue for people in the workplace. If that makes sense, you can't treat everybody the same. So you've got to be able to support the program at the executive level by talking about the things that they're interested in: return on net assets, return on investment, margin improvement, cost improvement, and on those activities. And you need someone. The other can also talk to the workforce about how it's going to make their job different, the opportunities that might create for them, and what their role will be. Because I firmly believe, and I put it in a note to you earlier when we talked about having this chat, that the only competitive advantage you've got is your people. If you can't get those people in a mindset where they are your competitive advantage, you're not going to have one, because you can buy a new piece of technology and within a year, all your competitors have got the same technology. Buy a new truck. Everyone else has got a new truck. You know, so the only thing that's different and an advantage that will stick with you is the mindset and the capability of your people. So I believe, in answer of your question, that was a long answer, Keith, I know, but I believe some support from a functioning BI team is really important over those immature periods of time. Just train people in a training program and then say, off you go, do your stuff, you know, run, is not going to get you the results that you want for starters, because you need someone to coach and mentor and nurture the different way of doing things in the organization.
This episode is brought to you by KPI Fire, the all-in-one platform for continuous improvement. With KPI Fire, you can align strategy, drive execution, and engage your people. So whether you're leading a team or driving enterprise-wide change, KPI Fire helps you deliver real results. Learn more at www.kpifire.com. So two topics there I want to drill into a little bit. The second one we'll come back to afterwards is the metrics that with what the business improvement department would own. But the first one I want to come to is this idea of the leaders inside the organization. Let's say the managers that knew that they had this business improvement team to call on and to work with. What would be maybe a difference between managers that really leaned in and did a great job working with the business improvement team versus managers that were kind of aloof and didn't? Is there anything that you would point out to?
Yeah,
let's say you're talking to a manager trying to say, hey, work with us.
Yeah, that's definitely the case. Unfortunately, that is the case where you have there are definitely people, I can't help it, I'm smirking because I can almost see their faces. You have those who say, this is my turf. You can, in Australia, bugger off. This is my turf, and I'll decide what happens here. I don't need anyone coming in and telling me what's to do. Look, again, from my perspective, I did a couple of things. One is we made sure we engaged with the regional leadership team right from the outset, so they were aware of all of this and they had an expectation. The second one with the operations, because the operations are by far the largest part of the organization. With the operations vice president, we would do laps to look at the change leader projects. He was pretty savvy. If a manager didn't have any change leader projects in their department, he'd in his subtle way, just ask the question, why not? Which is very, very helpful. You can beat your head against the wall all day and another person just ask a question and gets a response within the next month. You can be sure there'll be a change leader project underway. So you've got to use the organization you've got that's supporting you. would be my advice. Make sure they're aware of what's going on. Make sure they're aware of the approach being taken and what the expectations are, and get them to and leverage via those people. You're not a line manager. You can't, as a BI person, you can't direct. All you can do is facilitate, engage with departments, and almost be their best friend. Help them when they need it, but you have to rely on the organization to do the hard yards sometimes. If they're
And if you're helping them with their metrics, what are some metrics that your BI program owned yourselves?
Well, the obvious ones for starters would be cost. There's a really clear one. The other one is throughput, because like all industries, mining has got a constraint somewhere. Something throttles the whole process. It's like Elijah Goldratt's book, you know, The Goal.
Yeah, absolutely.
There's a constraint. You got to find Herbie in there somewhere, and it's all about every ton you get through that constraint is value that you've got that you're adding to the business or profit. So that would be the biggies. We would report on, as you know, number of new ideas. We try and keep that report up, although that's hard to do because there's a whole lot of informal stuff happens as well. Projects, cycle time, and value delivery at the end.
Very nice.
Be typically what we'd try.
If you were, let's say, kind of early in your career again, kind of starting over with things that the benefit of hindsight, are there some things that you tried to do that maybe you would say, yeah, that wasn't worth it? Or are there some, you know, kind of conversely, either one of these advice that you would say for somebody who's maybe like the first CI person inside their organization trying to build a program, any advice, avoid, move towards, or move away?
Okay. I would say right from the outset, not to try and do too much yourself. Because I think we're all guilty of that. We're all super enthusiastic and didn't necessarily use the leverage of the leadership structure that was in place. I tried to bring about the change myself, the fundamentals of change about, you know, I'm a fan of, just looking at him up here, Cotter, the Cotter model, where build the powerful guiding coalition. I didn't spend enough time on that. I was just wanted to get out there and get things done and show everyone how good I could do things. Where if I had have thought about Cotter and the change model, yeah, and if someone asked me what was my vision for the future, I probably couldn't have answered that apart from, you know, well, everybody will be doing all these really good things. So that would be what I would do differently from the start. I think we forget those lessons looking at his book, thinking I must have read that book six times, and you still forget some of the lessons that you pick up and learn from there.
So that's so true. So many of these lessons are like, you know, recursive, like, oh yeah, this is the same lesson. Are there?
My guard dog is watching.
Yeah, I love it when the dogs get to make a cameo on the podcast. I've got a dog that's sometimes with me as well. Pete, on that line of thinking, are there any improvements that maybe you guys picked up from other industries that you're like, from this other industry and it worked in mining?
Yeah, look, I think you pick up the differences as much as the improvements. Leaving power stations where it's fun, 70% of your cost in a power station is fuel, is coal or is gas. And the other 30% is everything else that takes place there. And any change you want to make is typically heavily based on engineering. So it's an engineered change. So when I came into the mining industry, it's almost the opposite. Any improvements that are made are typically made by people. Yeah, you've got new equipment and that's fantastic, don't get me wrong. And the drive now for automation is a whole new world when it comes to continuous improvement. But the biggest eye-opener I had was moving to an organization that was international and it had multiple different types of products. You know, iron ore, it had salt, it had diamonds, it had aluminium. So there's multiple different parts of the business. And the thing I couldn't understand when I started there, the thing I noticed about that was there was almost a competitive blocking of people sharing information between them between the different parts of the business. Sometimes you could even throw a stone from just about from one site to another site, but yet they wouldn't share. So we come up with these definitions: core, common, and specific. So if something was core to the an organization's, then it's got to be consistently done the same way across the organization. Common was you'd like it to be core. There are some foibles in there that would stop you from doing it consistently all the time, but you'd definitely like to see it over time gravitate towards core. And then specific was something like a ground condition where one place has got hard ground, one place has got soft ground. So it was specific to that location. Try and put practices into those buckets and say, well, we'd like as much as possible to be core. How do we standardize those things and have a commitment to standardizing the core things? And the common things, well, a little bit less emphasis on it, but you'd definitely like to work at getting it as a core. And specific, okay, how do we optimize how we operate with those in those specific items? It gave us a framework. We got some start on standardizing some of those things, but when I left that organization, there was still a lot more work to be done.
So you would kind of use that framework to decide if a change could be applied somewhere else in the organization? Okay.
Yeah,
that makes sense.
So if you apply, maybe you've already got a solution. Maybe that solution is a core, and you could apply it across the organization. It's just standard, a lunch cutter.
Yeah, I love it. I love it. Okay, Pete, let's go into this rapid fire section.
Right,
so the most important job of a leader is to blank.
Most important leader is to demonstrate with their behaviors. Their commitment is to ensure everybody has an understanding of the direction of the organization, and then to be the cheer squad. If I can drop a name on here, years ago, Sam Walsh, who went on to become the CEO of Rio Tinto. I remember watching him at Boyne Smelter up in Queensland, and they were doing 5S training, and he had his hard hat, his white overalls on, mouth mask and gloves, and had a shovel and a broom, and he was sweeping up the dust and the bauxite and stuff and joining in with the other guys doing this 5S exercise. There's Bill, he was at Bingham Canyon where you are, Bill Champion, who was one of the first wave of green belt training and was one of the first to finish his green belt project. Now, people notice these things, whether you want to or you don't want to, whether you want to say, oh, that's just smoke and mirrors. Doesn't matter. You've noticed them committing and participating.
Yeah. That's great. Is there a book you recommend, one or more?
Look, I still love the old, I still read it, The Machine That Changed the World. I do find, as you know, Leading Change by Cotter. I don't even know whose blogs I read, but I'm a bit more of a blog reader these days than a book reader. So I'm not much help to you there, I'm afraid.
Any blogs that you like to follow that you want to?
I knew you were going to ask me that. whatever I find on a particular day or night when I go on and log in, and if there's something there from you, Keith, I mean, I have really enjoyed the previous Fireside Chat stuff. I got to admit, very human.
Excellent.
It's good.
Thank you.
Still get some case studies through friends who work in different organizations. I've got them, some of those down there, some of the bigger ones, the BHPs and the like in the that are working there. And some of those are fascinating. And you say, this is really good, but that was done 10 years ago, and now it's rebadged and it's really good again.
Funny how much a history repeats itself.
Oh, yeah.
In terms of like the Lean Toolbox, continuous improvement tools, is there a tool, a particular tool that you are fond of that you kind of like a go-to?
Yeah, look, there are. Depends.
What's your favorite?
Can I only have one?
How about your top three?
Okay. When an organization is just starting out, visualization through their performance boards is fantastic. Short story, I promise it's short. I was working up at a diamond mine in Northwest Territories in Canada, and we set up, you got to pick a spot somewhere to put your first visual information board and run your daily meetings around that. So we set the one up at the superintendent level in the mine, and we're running those meetings, and they're going fantastically well, and they can see production is trending up and utilization of equipment is trending up. I was in there sitting with the superintendent. We're trying to work out how, because the truck operators and excavator operators have their meeting in the next room. And I was sitting in there talking to the superintendent, how are we going to get these other guys interested in this information, in running the meetings the same way? And we're scratching our head, how are we going to get them interested? One of them come and knocked on the door. Said, excuse me. Yeah. Can we have something like this so we know what we're doing too? Because we've been looking at yours and we'd really like to have that out here so we can see how we're going every day. I thought, how ignorant. You just believe that other people won't be interested in it because they don't have the same status as the superintendent and his direct reports. And that was a real eye-opener. So operating centres, we call them operating centres, that would be my number one favourite. I love this and the seven weights or the eight weights, this depends on which school you're at, because they are so simple to talk to people about. Yes, I'm one of those that still uses the lean toast, the video that's mentioned in one of your earlier.
Bruce was on chats. Our podcast, yeah.
It's cheesy, but it still gets the point across. Yeah. So there's that from a benefit. Now, one that's really, really growing on me is the standardized work. There's some activity going on in some iron ore operations who have got typically, 70 or 80 haul trucks. These are 300-ton trucks. So standardized work for maintenance, you imagine with 80 haul trucks and standardizing the work, where you've got a variation between 1 hour to carry out a task and an hour and a half, and you've got 80 haul trucks. That's a big impact on your production. So I'm seeing some work take place there from an ex-Toyota employee, and he's doing some standardized work there, and it really is making a difference.
Mm.
So it's growing on me. It's working its way up towards the top favorite list.
I'm a big fan of standard work. We'll have teased some functionality in KPI Fire on that topic. So
yeah,
stay tuned on that one.
Okay, watch this one.
Okay, how about this one? Do you have a favorite question?
How do you know?
How do you know? I like that. I like that. Or like in the context of are you improving or do you have a problem? How do you know? I love it.
How do you know? Great one.
Okay, this is another finish the sentence. Continuous improvement is?
Headache. The vehicle for organizations to achieve the full potential, achieve their full
potential. I love it. I love it. Well, Pete, what are you most excited about now at this point in life? What are you looking forward to?
Look, it's hard to leave. That's the frustrating bit. It's hard. I still hang around like I'm looking for little scraps of what's going on. Hard to walk away. There's such an exciting career. Now at my age, at 65, what am I looking forward to? Well, the new four-wheel drive's parked in the carport, and the caravan's there, and we're heading up into the middle of the Pilbara and the Ayers Rock and the Northern Territory, and so that's what occupies the next bit.
Wonderful. Wonderful.
But I will still look forward to the telephone calls on how things are going and from different people that I've been fortunate enough to work with over the years.
So, Pete, is there any questions that I should have asked you that I did not ask you?
We covered off the one that I really want. I heard a term at General Electric up in Maine, and they called something a bootleg team. Have you heard that phrase?
No. What is a bootleg team?
Well, I heard on one of the other fireside chats about not letting lean become a means of getting rid of people. And what they did up in the GE plant in Maine was when they made an improvement, and as a consequence of that, they had left people over that they didn't require anymore. They formed a separate team, which that team was, say, a boilermaker and a fitter and an electrician and, whatever that happened to be. And they would go and make further improvements around the business. And it was based on bootlegging being the old whiskey.
Yeah.
So I really like that. The bootleg team really sort of stuck in my head, because you always get that question, you know, by the naysayers in the room. So you make some improvement and we'll get the sack, which sadly has been sometimes the case. You know, the organizations just go through and cut. But
I like the idea. I mean, it's nice when an organization can make some capacity for improvement, you know, especially, I mean, particularly if it's like the full effort of a person or something like
I thought that was a really good, they understood the impact that it would be. It wasn't a big place. I think it was that they produced generator parts. It wasn't a big production plant, and they knew the impact of if they started putting people off every time they made an improvement. So I thought that was pretty good. So why didn't you ask me about bootleg teams? I don't think so. One of your questions that I thought you might have said was, what were the milestones for me in my career?
Yeah. What were those milestones?
It wasn't really transitioning from electricity into mining was a big change. The bigger change was when I started working in Indonesia and Papua New Guinea and Africa and Australia and the US and Canada, actually seeing the application of these things across the globe in different cultures who think differently, act differently. And that to me was probably the biggest milestone of my working life. Some cultures are used to being told and almost feel uncomfortable when you ask them, what are your thoughts? Or you tell me what my thoughts are. And then there's others that are very headstrong the other way. That was, I guess, a real learning for me. It was fantastic to understand that this is the impact of different cultures on a business improvement program or any program.
It sounds like there's an insight in there. I mean, maybe the way that you approach it has to be different, but it sounds like there's some common threads there about the business improvement discipline. How would you summarize that to say the thing that works across all of those different cultures?
People, you need to work out a way, I believe, to show people that it's going to work. It's going to make their job or their life or their, you know, whatever better. And for some, that's money. For others, that's an opportunity to do things differently and take more responsibility. It's just a matter of finding out what good looks like. How will they know when it's better? So it's really finding that.
Yeah,
but it's the end of the day, it's a great feeling to help people. It's a horrible feeling when you're just stuffing them around, but it's a great feeling. It's just a great feeling to help people and make their job better and give them opportunity. Yeah, when you can walk away and said we've had a great week, because that's what we've done. It's a good job.
Well, Pete, those have been some great answers. This has been a great conversation. I want to thank you so much for joining us today. Really appreciate your time and your experience.
No, thanks, Keith. It's least we can do. You've been, in my time from 2018, you were a huge help when it came to setting up KPI Fire, and a real credit to you. People have been keen to help us as well, so I'm very pleased.
No, thanks so much, Pete. For our listeners, if you'd like to suggest a guest, ask a question, or give us any ideas for episodes or content, feel free to reach out to me, Keith Norris, on LinkedIn. And this concludes this episode of KPI Fireside, a continuous improvement podcast. If you've enjoyed the episode today, be sure to add a comment. You can like or follow, subscribe on all the socials, and share the podcast with your friends or colleagues who are as passionate about continuous improvement as you are. You can find us wherever you get your podcast. Until next time, keep driving progress and sparking change.